Thousands of years ago, the philosopher Aristotle came up with a novel concept about understanding something. He talked about understanding the causes of something. And for a couple thousand years, his four causes have been very, very influential. In the past number of years, though, one of those causes, which in my thinking was probably the most important one in his thinking as well, has been pushed away by people. And that has comes at a very steep cost. And that's what I want to look at today on the program. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. This is part of a series I've been doing called Philosophy and Faith. We're now on number 12, and it's titled What Aristotle Got Right. Now, that might not mean much to you unless you saw the last program, which was called What Aristotle Got Wrong. And we looked in that last program at his cosmology, his false understanding of some of the nature of the cosmos, specifically its geography, and what the implications were for that when, unfortunately, the church had accepted that as the gospel truth, and then, with plenty of egg on its face, found itself on the wrong side of history and science. And what I wanted to show is that the same thing is happening in today. That is, the church, so eager to kiss up to the latest and greatest in science and culture, in many cases has made the same mistake, which in this case is taking hold of a false science, particularly evolution, and seeking to incorporate it into Christian theology. Anyway, if you missed it, it was called What Aristotle Got Wrong. Today, the talk is What Aristotle Got Right. Now, I realized in the last program when I introduced Aristotle, I never really spent much time talking about him as a man. And he must have been an incredibly fascinating character. And again, the mind on this man was astounding. Anyway, Aristotle was born in a place called Stagira, a small town in which is now, I believe, Macedonia. And his father was court physician to the king. And when Aristotle was 18, he entered Plato's Academy, where he sped the next 20 years. And certainly, as one lecturer said it, he spent 20 years there not because he was a bad student or a slow learner. Instead, he was the star pupil of Plato. I just couldn't imagine sitting there and listening to Plato and Aristotle delving into philosophy. Now, no one knows how long it was before Aristotle started to deviate from his teacher. But it happened, and a good hunk of his writings are, in some degree, a response to what he believed his teacher, Plato, got wrong. Now, Aristotle was, in many ways, what we call today a biologist, a scientist. And as such, he was very interested in how the world appeared to us in the here and now, unlike his teacher Plato, whose focus was on the unchanging world of the forms, whatever they supposedly existed, whatever they were. Aristotle wanted to focus on the here, on the now, on the down to earth, on what's before us, what we can see, feel, taste, touch, and so on. He was more of a scientist than a metaphysician, though he was into metaphysics as well. You might want to describe the analogy, the difference between them, with an analogy. And it's often what's often called nominalism and universalism. And if you have an interest in philosophy, these are terms worth knowing. What do I mean? Well, let's take the color red. Think of a red rose, a red book, a red painting, or even a bucket of red paint. Let's say they're all the same shade of red, or at least as close as possible. Now, the question is, what do they all have in common? Well, that's stupid. Well, of course, they're all red. If you got rid of the color red, you might have a yellow rose, you might have a white rose, you might have a green painting, and maybe a can of white paint. The red was gone. But here the question is, where did the red go? Or let's put it another way. Did the red in the red paint, the red rose, the red book, did or does it have a separate existence apart from these things? From these things? Think about it for a minute. Try to think of the idea. What is pure redness? We can conjure up an image of redness in our mind, even apart from a red book or a red painting or something. But what about red as pure red, apart from anything else? Does it have some kind of a universal existence apart from anything that it's a part of? I mean, we could think of the word red, and I can speak the word red, and you can read the word red, but that is, none of those sounds or those words or anything is red. Even if you read the letter R-E-D, and they were written in red type, the redness itself is part of the type on the page or the pixelation on the computer screen. Is there pure redness apart from any, to use the Aristotelian terms, accidents? A universalist such as you might call Plato would say yes. Pure redness exists in the mysterious world of the forms. And whatever we have here that's red, a red bucket, a red rose, a red painting, whatever, it's just a changing and chimerical shadow of pure universal redness. In contrast, nominalists from the word name say, no way, no way, get all of that uber, get rid of all that uber speculative metaphysical mumbo jumbo. Red is just the name we give to a particular mix of molecules that are found in various things. And when lights hit those molecules, they appear to our eyes as the color red. Don't go looking in some platonic realm for redness. The only universal is the name we give it. Red redness exists only in things themselves or in the concepts of our minds. If there is a universal for redness, it's not some physical thing out there, but is instead just the idea of redness that we have in our thinking. Only the concept, only the idea of red is universal, but its existence depends totally upon the mind thinking it. Apart from them, it's nothing. This was definitely more where Aristotle was, as opposed to Plato. And his idea, and Aristotle's idea of getting down and dirty, getting into the facts on the ground, so to speak, leads us where I want to go to Aristotle today. Was where I want to go with him. Because he was so interested in the natural world, in the physical world, he wanted to know, what did it mean to have knowledge of something? To have something in this world. In many ways, I believe epistemology is the first science. And epistemology is a study of what it means to know something. Now, if that's true, it's very interesting because it makes us, the subject, the knower, crucial in the concept of knowledge and the concept of truth. Now, I've touched on this on other shows. But how can there be knowledge without some conscious entity to be in relationship to that knowledge? The concept of knowledge itself, apart from a conscious entity, is as silly as the concept of pain without an object that can feel pain. I mean, otherwise, what? Do pain and knowledge somehow exist alone, somewhere floating out in the cosmos apart from anything at all? Can even a thought exist without a mind? I don't think so. Thus, anyway, for Aristotle, anyway, the scientists want to explain, as Aristotle the scientist wanted to explain what it meant for us to know something about the natural world. And in his books, Physics, he in the first few short paragraphs, he explains his version of epistemology. At least what it means to know physical reality. Just a few short paragraphs he wrote here, but I can't tell you how many forests have been cut down over the centuries, expounding on what he wrote. For Aristotle, for us to know something, first and foremost, means for us to know its causes. In physics, he wrote, let me read you. Now that we have established these distinctions, we must proceed to consider causes, their character and their number. Knowledge is the object of our inquiry, and men do not think they know a thing until they grasp the why of it, which is to grasp its primary causes. Cause. What caused something? Or as I've said here before on this show, the perennial question, why is there something instead of nothing? To have the answer for that something as opposed to nothing is in Aristotle's thinking to know the cause. It's interesting, too, if you think about it. The opening line of the Bible. What is the opening line of the Bible? It's all about causes. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that's not about causes, folks, I don't know what is. Thus, for Aristotle, if you want to get to know something, to understand what it is, what it's for, what it does, first and foremost, you have to know his causes. Now, in his book, The Physics, he then lists what he deems are the four principal causes of a thing. Aristotle was nothing if not precise. I mean, this man had an amazing capacity for breaking things down into their constituent elements, be they physical, logical, whatever. He wanted to get at the core of things. And he talks about the four causes and using titles that he specifically himself didn't use, but that were used by later scholastics and have been come through the centuries. They're known as the material cause, the efficient cause, the formal cause, and the final cause. First, the material cause. He says, in one way then, that out of which a thing comes to be and which persists is called a cause, e.g. the bronze of a statue, the silver of a bowl. What, in other words, what is the material substance that something is made of? I mean, this table is made of glass, or this of steel, or whatever. Simple enough. It's the material cause. What is something made of? Okay? Easy enough. He then talks about what has been called the formal cause. What is the form of something? He used a rather difficult example in physics for that, but he does talk about the form or the pattern of something. It's like I can have a pile of bricks before me. They're just the material cause is the bricks. There's a pile of bricks, just a pile of bricks sitting there. But if I come back the next day and I have a fireplace, what has changed? It's still the same material, the same bricks, but what does it have now that it didn't have before? Of course, it has a form, it has a shape, it has a form and shape that give it function. In fact, this cause, called the formal cause, is directly tied to the function. A pile of bricks does not a fireplace make. A pile of bricks in the form of a fireplace does a fireplace make. So first you got the material cause, what it's made out of, and then the formal cause, the form of something. Next, Aristotle talks about, quote, the agent whereby a change is produced. In other words, in the case of a pile of bricks, which is the material cause, and the form of the fireplace, which is the formal cause, we have what has been called the efficient cause. That which made a pile of bricks into a fireplace. I mean, it wasn't in the bricks themselves to turn into a fireplace. In this case, then, the efficient cause would be, I guess, the bricklayer. So what do we have? We have the material cause. What a thing is made out of? Metal. The formal cause, the form or the shape of it. And then you've got the efficient cause, that which whatever took this metal and turned it into the shape. Those are three. We said there were four. We now come to what has been called the final cause. In other words, what is the purpose of it all? What is the reason for it all? What was it made? Why was it made to begin with? Okay, Aristotle uses a funny example, but he says that when a person is asked why they are walking, they say they are walking, quote, in order to be healthy. That is the end purpose of that act. Well, in the same way, the final purpose of the bricks, of the material cause, and the form of the fireplace, the formal cause, and the bricklayer, the efficient cause, is to do what fireplaces do. Provide heat, to provide a place to cook, and other things as well. That is the final cause. It could be argued that for Aristotle, the final cause, the telos, which means purpose, is the most important one. It's the one that the other three causes are all aiming for. He wrote, all these things are for the sake of the end, though they differ from one another in that some are activities, others instruments. In other words, this final cause, this telios, this purpose is very, very important in Aristotle's thinking, and rightly so. Aristotle once famously said, nature does nothing purposely. Well, that idea is nature does nothing in vain. In other words, there's a reason, a purpose, a plan. Dare I say it? Sounds heresy today. A design in nature. And that's because nature, according to Aristotle, does nothing purposely. Well, that was many long, long centuries ago. Aristotle lived and wrote a few hundred years before Christ. But later on, it's fascinating, but later on in the physics, Aristotle deals with what could be called a form of evolutionary theory. The idea that things rose by chance. See, many people think that Darwin came up with the idea of evolution, and that's not true, folks. You can find way back in ancient Egypt and onwards this idea that life kind of evolved, a chance kind of thing. In fact, it was the pre-Socratic philosopher Anaximander, who predated Aristotle by a few hundred years, who had written, man was like other animals, namely a fish in the beginning. I mean, folks, this was 500 years before Christ. All Darwin did was supposedly find the mechanism for how this all happened, natural selection and random mutation, which, of course, many folks, myself included, radically disagree with. But the point is, Aristotle, way back then, knowing people might not agree with his final cause, this idea that everything has a design, a purpose, a telos, he dealt with it back then. That is over 2,000 years before Darwin. We had already somebody arguing against this Darwinian worldview. Now, his argument is simple and has something to it, though no doubt no evolutionist would take it today seriously, and I'm not sure how good of an argument it is anyway. I still find it interesting that you've got somebody thousands of years ago already arguing from trying to use logic and reason to argue against the idea of no chance, no design in nature. He said simply, he talked about the natural world. He said, if these things, these obvious ends and purposes were by chance, why are there so many of them? I mean, for example, look at teeth. They have the purpose of chewing. They're there for chewing. Now, Aristotle did write that, quote, they come to be as they do either almost or either always or usually. In other words, almost in all cases, they come as they're supposed to come. If they were by chance, they wouldn't come as often as they do. It would be hit and miss. I mean, how often are you going to roll a pair of sixes? But because these things, which seem to clearly have been produced for a projected end, I mean, I think fingers are here for a reason, either because they, to quote Aristotle, happen either always or usually, then they really aren't the result of a crapshoot, but they're there, they've been made purposely. Now, I know, of course, the modern evolutionists will claim to have answers for all this and so on, but that's not really where I want to go anyway. Instead, where I want to go is here. Aristotle had his epistemology, how we know something, and he argued that we know it by knowing its origins, its causes. And he listed the four causes, and which have come down to us as material, formal, efficient, and final. And you could argue that for him, the final cause was the most important one. It was the reason for all the others. It was, as he said, the sake of the end, the reason for them. The bricks, the form of the fireplace, the bricklayer, weren't ends in themselves. No, the end in itself was the fireplace, which was used for a purpose. That's what I believe Aristotle got right. And what's amazing is that today, for many years now, that final cause, that final why, is rejected by most thinkers. I mean, they'll accept all the other causes, but there is no final cause, no final purpose, no final why. Not in an, you know, no why in an atheistic Darwinian worldview. You can't have a final cause. You can't have a final why. You can't why? Because that would imply some sort of design, some sort of consciousness going into something. And so much of modern thinking says, no, 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 no. We don't need that anymore. Darwin got rid of that for us anymore. Got rid of that for us. But as I said, folks, it didn't start with Darwin. As the scientific revolution started progressing, thinkers, they wanted the material cause. I mean, how can you get rid of the material cause? I mean, we're here. They wanted the formal cause. I mean, you can't do without the form. And they wanted the efficient cause. I mean, you needed something to put it together. Somehow it had to get there. That's fine. They wanted all that. But they didn't want the final cause. They didn't want an end, a goal, a purpose, because that would imply some sort of conscious reasoning. That would imply some sort of conscious reason existing outside of it. And who or what that would that be but some sort of divine being? And they didn't have a good answer to get rid of it, final causes. At least they didn't until Darwin. Then suddenly, just like that, voila, excuse my French, no more need for a God because we have random mutation and natural selection, cold, unconscious, and purposeless forces. Interesting, Aristotle said that nature did nothing purposely. Modern atheistic thinking says nature does everything purposely, purposelessly. You know, I think Aristotle got it right this time. I mean, if the other view is correct, then no more conscious thought went into some kid scribbling an alphabet for the first time in her life than went into all the cosmos. More consciousness, more purpose, more thought went into that than into the creation of a human being. That's at least what we're led to believe by those who have rejected Aristotle's final cause. It's not an easy argument to buy into. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, there's reason, there's purpose in these things. That is at least ultimately. Of course, even Richard Dawkins believes that the purpose for teeth is to chew. He just doesn't think they came about purposely, that's all. They just evolved, helping those who had teeth survive better against those who didn't have teeth. What sheer luck. My teeth are stronger than yours, and so I survive and you die, and I pass my gene on while yours and those who inherited your dull teeth end up in the dustbin of history. Makes me think of Primo Levi, a Holocaust survivor, who went on in later years to kill himself. Talk about irony. Survives the Holocaust only to kill himself. But there's an irony in all this too, the preface to his book, Survival at Auschwitz, began, "It was my good fortune to be deported to Auschwitz only in 1944. That is, after the German government had decided, owing to growing scarcity of labor, to lengthen the average lifespan of the prisoners destined for extermination." His good fortune. Whew, the irony there, and it's bitter, bitter, bitter. Anyway, Levy tells about a guard at Auschwitz who had been abusing a prisoner. And Levy went up to protest. And this is fascinating. It's really kind of creepy. He goes up and asks the prisoner, the guard, "Why are you doing this? Why are you doing?" And he said the guard in German screamed back at him, "Herr ist keine Warum." There is no why here. That's heavy. There is no why here. There is no why in Auschwitz and in the modernist, purely materialistic worldview. There is no why there either. Things just happened by chance. This is what modern science is telling us. No final purpose, no teleos, no goal. Things just evolved and we happen to be the result, but there's no real purpose for it all. We're going to be told just get better and better. French philosopher Henri Bergson was convinced that humans were going to ultimately progress, infinitely progress. Funny sentiment for a man who died in 1941, just as the war was taking off and the Holocaust was getting into full swing. In the end, though, that's what modern science ultimately tells us. Keine Warum, no why here. But I don't think that's a sufficient answer. Science doesn't give us a why. It can give us a lot of formulas. It can give us a lot of principles. It could, I mean, saying that something moves using the form F equal, the formula F equals MA, or E equals MC squared, are great achievements, powerful achievements. But they are not necessarily an explanation. They're descriptions of things. Newton's inverse square law is great. It's helpful. It describes what happens, but it surely doesn't explain it. They're descriptions. After all, is there not, if there is no purpose, no end goal, no teleos, just accidents, as they call it, that's all it is. And what kind of explanation is that? What kind of explanation could there really ever be? I like this quote by Neil Postman. He says, but in the end, science does not provide the answers most of us require. Its story of our origins and our ends is, to say at least, unsatisfactory. To the question, how did it all begin? Science answers, probably by an accident. To the question, how will it all end? Science answers, probably by an accident. And to many people, the accidental life is not worth living. Moreover, the science God has no answers to the question, why are we here? And to the question, what moral instructions do you give us? The science God maintains silence. No teleos, no final cause, no ultimate purpose. That's what we're told. Aristotle, on the other hand, said it all pointed to final causes. What do you think? I mean, in your heart, not your mind, what does your heart tell you? Doesn't it tell you that you're more than an accident, that your life has a purpose? At the same time, use your head, use your brain, use your reason. And if you do, you will see that Aristotle, living way back when, was still millennia ahead of many of today's most influential and powerful thinkers.